We're in chapter 42 and verse 1 through 6. In fact, let's read verse 1 and 2. Then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that thou canst do everything, and that no thought can be withholden from thee. Again, we go back to just a little bit of review. Remember that after Job's three friends had tried to tell him that he had secret sin he needed to confess, which was not really true. And then there was a third man who evidently had listened in on all of their conversations, and he admitted that he was younger and he had respected the elder, and so he'd kept his mouth shut till they were done, and he threw his 2 cents worth in as well, which wasn't a whole lot different. He pretty much approached the same thing that, Job, you have these problems that you're going through because you have sinned, and that's the reason God is punishing you for that very reason, which again was not true. And then after going through all of that and Job defends himself, then finally God speaks and really, to a great degree, really humbles Job in the fact that he reminded him that he wasn't there when he created everything and that he was, again, sovereign God and he could choose to do whatever he chooses to do. And Job had to simply fit into that. And, of course, he went back through the subject matter of the creation with the behemoth and the leviathan, these huge, apparently, animals, even sometimes referred to as dragons, that existed in Job's day, and how marvelous they were, and that God had created those, and that God was in control of all things. So when we come to chapter 42, then we have Job again speaking as he answers to God in relationship to God speaking to him. So in verse 1 and 2 that we just read, it is obvious that he senses the presence of God. Job freely acknowledges God's power and his omniscience, that he knows all things. God can do anything. God knows every thought. Job spiritually prostrated himself before God. He admitted his problem. He realized that he was mere human and God was in control, and he had no right to question God even in his difficult circumstances. In verse 3, who is he that hideth counsel without knowledge? Therefore have I uttered that I understand not things too wonderful for me, which I knew not. So Job admitted that there were many things about creation and the things of which God has made that he did not know and did not understand. Job had been wrong in his criticism of life, and he acknowledged that God was good and that God was in control, and he acknowledged that of him. And remember, when I talk about his criticism of life, he often said, well, you know, been better if I hadn't died or that I'd never been conceived. And he pretty much was very bitter at life. And you can understand that when you realize the things of which he went through, realizing that he lost every single material possession, and he was a wealthy man. He lost every one of his children, and so he lost everything, and then finally God allowed Satan to take his health. So after going through all of that, I think we can understand why he may have simply given up on life and wished that he had never been born. But he now realizes that he should not have made those statements about his life. In verse 4, hear, I beseech thee, and I will speak. I will demand of thee, and declare thou unto me. So Job now asked God to speak to him. He said, Lord, if you speak, I will listen. Now that he was humbled, he asked God to tell him what he should do, his next step in life. In verse 5, I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. Job knew of God, and that obviously was true way back in chapter 1, where it talks about the fact that he did hate evil and he did love the Lord. So he did know the Lord in that sense, but he had never seen him personally. And of course, in the book of Job, it talks about God spoke to him out of the whirlwind. So God did reveal himself to Job in a very unusual way. Job knew that what he knew because he had learned it through hearing in the ear gate. But now God had actually revealed himself to Job in a very personal way. Much as God appeared to Abraham in the plains of Mamre, so he had appeared to Job visibly in visible form. And he acknowledges that here, now mine eye seeth thee. So he had a rare and unusual privilege. In verse 6, wherefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. After going through all of this, Job literally abhorred himself. Like Isaiah in Isaiah chapter 6, when Isaiah saw the throne of God, he said, "Woe is me, for I am undone because I am a man of unclean lips." Job saw himself much the same way that Isaiah did when he actually saw the presence of God. He realized who he was and what he was, that he was nothing, and he abhorred himself. And thus it says that he repented in dust and ashes. Here we see Job truly broken and contrite in spirit. I like the verse in Psalms 51:17 that says, "The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit. A broken and a contrite heart, O God, thou wilt not despise." And that is a challenging verse to me in particular. In fact, it's one of those I have in my packet of memory verses that I go over regularly. And I think about that. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit. You know, we probably have a tendency to pat ourselves on the back. You know, we read our Bibles, we go to church. Every time the church door is open, we do all of these things. But when it comes down to the honesty of it all, is that what God's really impressed with? The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit. You can look at that any way you want to look at it, but that honestly is humbling. What God is pleased with is for humbleness on our part, that we get off our pride and realize the sacrifice of God, what God really enjoys, is a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart, O God, thou wilt not despise. All of us, to one degree or another, have, you ever heard that expression, our pride, I have my pride? That's honest, we do. Every single one of us have our pride. Right. That is what this is talking about. The sacrifices of God are a broken and a contrite heart. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit. And after Job went through all of these things, that's really where he was. He had come to the point of a broken spirit. After all this time, Job's heart was finally what you would call refined. Was Job wicked? No. Was Job a sinner like his friends tried to tell him? No. Was he perfect as far as sinless? No, no man is. And yet, it was through all of these experiences, having everything taken from him, that finally he found that experience of the broken heart. A righteous and a proud Job had become a righteous and a humble man. And because Job had been successful in life, I mean, you'd have to admit, wouldn't you, that when it tells about all the animals he owned, he was a success. He had succeeded. At least as we would look at life, we would say, well, he did quite well for himself. But that really wasn't what God appreciated and enjoyed. And God allowed Satan to take everything he had. In the end, Job realized he lost that pride. He became humble before God. He had become a very humble man. Now, he was convinced of God's righteous control over everything. And he admitted that, Lord, you do own everything. You do control everything. And then you took it all away from me, and you have the right to do that. And he learned from that. He was convinced that God really was righteous. When we believers question the ways of God or complain to him, we actually doubt his character. And I still think probably we're all guilty of that. We try to talk about that as we've gone through the book of Job, but we have a tendency to think that as a believer, everything should always go right because, well, we prayed, we talked to God about it, and everything should always be just right. But that isn't true. God may choose in his sovereign character to take away what we have or not allow us to have things that we might desire and want to have and think that, oh, if I could only do that and accomplish that, I'd be successful. And so when something does happen, we have a tendency to question God. Does God know what he's doing? God couldn't do this to me. Well, I'm a believer. Because of a conversation I had with someone else, I mentioned this to the individual I was talking about, but, and I've told you this before, but when our daughter Dory, our youngest daughter, was 11 years old, I guess it was, when she was going through a routine camp physical. And after the doctor was done, he came out and spoke to my wife. He said, "Are you aware that she has a heart problem?" My wife was quite shocked. "No. In fact, she hadn't been to the doctor since she was a baby. I don't think she's perfectly healthy." He said, "Well, I really think you need to go to a heart specialist and have her checked out." He said, "There's something that isn't right." Well, we looked at her. She looked perfectly healthy to us. But we figured the doctor maybe knows more than we do, so we did set up an appointment to a heart specialist and took her to the doctor, and the heart specialist confirmed the fact. He said, "You know, she really does have a rather serious problem. But I think you need to take her to a child's heart specialist." Okay, dumb as we were, we didn't know there was such thing as a children's heart specialist at that time. Suppose we should have that, but it wasn't something that concerned us, so we hadn't bothered our minds with it. So we made an appointment and took her to a child's heart specialist, and he confirmed the fact. He said she has not only has a serious problem, but he said, "I think it needs dealt with." And he said, "I think you need to put her in the hospital, and we'll do a catheterization and go up and look in the heart, because there's something definitely wrong." And so we submitted to that, and she went in the hospital and did the catheterization. And they confirmed that she was missing part of one of her valves in the top of her heart, which made a malfunction of the way the blood would pump. And as a result of that, he explained it. He said it was like a whirlpool. In a whirlpool, the debris gathers around the outside. That's what her blood is doing. So the calcium deposits and things like that gather around that. And eventually that will make the valve so it doesn't work. And therefore, something really needs to be done. And he suggested that they go in and clip out some of the material, because he explained to us it was like a webbing on a duck's foot. He said, "You cut that webbing out of there, it will let the blood flow," and he said she may get along for a long time before she actually has to have a valve put in, either artificial or whatever they would do with a pig's valve, and I guess they do beef valves now as well. So we waited. He said, "You don't have to do it immediately," but he said somewhere in the next year you ought to consider it. So we waited. Then we did start to notice some things that weren't normal. When she would have a fever and a cold, you could feel right here in the nape of her neck. It was like water going through a hose. Not normal. You could tell it was not right. And then we noticed her fingernails were purple instead of pink. So we submitted her to the surgery. But I remember before that happened, I told the Lord, "I don't understand this. I'm a preacher. I believe the Bible. I'm saved. We're both saved. Our family is saved. We love you, Lord. And why would you do this to us? I don't understand that." And then, like a dummy, the Holy Spirit spoke to me and said, "Look, you're no different than anybody else. Why shouldn't you have to go through a trial like anybody else?" And from that moment on, I had peace. When she went into the surgery, I told the Lord, "If you're done with her on earth, you can take her. That's all right." My wife and I agreed. She lived through it. Pastor's wife now, had five babies, still has the same heart valve. God knows what He's doing. Did I choose to go through that? No. Would I want to choose to go through that? No. But it was a good experience. Fortunately, it came out good. But they don't always come out good. We're not exempt from those things. We tend to think that if somebody has a problem, there's something wrong with them spiritually. That's not true. It can be true, yes, but we have no right to ever make that judgment. And that's the story of Job, the whole experience. God took these things away from him. When Job got done, he was humbled. He finally admitted, "It is true, I am nothing." And it was because of that that God definitely then blessed him and used him along the way. To finish up just quickly this last set of notes, a righteous and a proud Job had become a righteous and a humble man. Now he was convinced of God's righteous control over all things. When we believers question the ways of God or complain to Him, we actually doubt His character. God will never to do anything to contradict any of his divine perfections. No longer did Job try to defend himself. He now saw himself as he really was. He sat in ashes and sprinkled dust on his head. And that last verse there, that verse 6 that we read, when he says, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. That's where we should be. We aren't always there, but that's where we should be. Lord, I repent in dust and ashes. Moving to the set of notes we just passed out, this one I entitled as Restored, because that's literally what happened. The story of Job began with God's affirmation of Job's integrity and Satan's false accusation of Job. The story closes with Job's spiritual integrity still intact and with God's vindication of him completed. God did restore and bless Job. Job was blessed in 10 ways, and I've listed them here. Number one, he was vindicated by God. Second, he was restored to good health. Third, he was comforted by family and friends. Fourth, given double his original wealth. Five, given 10 more children. Six, given an additional 140 years. Given many descendants. Blessed in having an encounter with God. Blessed in having encountered himself. And that really summarizes pretty much the things that ended up with Job in the end. We begin with God's vindication of Job, chapter 42, verse 7, and it was so that after the Lord had spoken these words unto Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, my wrath is kindled against thee and against thy two friends, for ye have not spoken of me the thing that is right, as my servant Job hath. So God made it plain to Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar that he basically was angry with them. Their conclusions had all been wrong. He also said that Job had spoken correctly. God had no criticism of Job. This verse is critical to understanding, I think, the whole book of Job. Even though God did ask those questions of Job that we studied last week, where were you when I laid the foundation of the world? God wasn't being critical of Job. He was just trying to help Job to understand basically what he was going through. But God was not critical of Job. This verse is critical to understand, I think, the whole book. In verse 8, therefore take unto you now 7 bullocks and 7 rams, and go to my servant Job, and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering, and my servant Job shall pray for you, and him will I accept, lest I deal with you after your folly, and that ye have not spoken of me the thing which is right, like my servant Job. So they were to take 7 cows, 7 sheep to Job and have him offer them to God on their behalf. In doing so, Job would then pray for their forgiveness. God would accept Job because he taught truth. If they did not do this, God would deal with them. God would chasten them if they did not sacrifice for their sins. Now this goes back again to chapter 1. When Job basically was dealing with his family, he served as their priest. Now, at that time, the law obviously had not been given. There was no Mosaic law, so there was no law that determined who was to give the sacrifices. And so it does talk about back in chapter 1 that Job sacrificed on the benefit of his family and his children. And that seemed to have been the practice from the time that Adam and Eve came out of the Garden of Eden, that it was the head of the family's responsibility to offer sacrifices for their sin, which that's why you have the story of Cain and Abel bringing their sacrifices to God. Abel brought the animal, was accepted, where Cain brought vegetation, was not accepted. But that was learned from their parents as God instructed them. Then there isn't a whole lot said about that until the time that Noah came out of the ark. And when Noah came out of the ark, the first thing he did was, again, to take a clean animal and offer a sacrifice to God. So that had been a pattern, and it was a pattern even before the Mosaic Law. And when the Mosaic Law then came, it just gave far more details to that, but it continued what started at the very beginning when they came out of the Garden of Eden. So because Job had successfully again sacrificed in the benefit of his family, now God said for these 3 men, you need to have Job go ahead and do a sacrifice for you that they might obtain forgiveness of their sin. So God granted Job the ministry of praying for his 3 friends in verse 8. As is indicated, he prayed for his 3 friends. Because there were not official priests at that time, Job was to function as their priest to intercede for them. And I remind you, and I printed it in your notes for you, Matthew 5:44, I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good unto them that hate you, pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. That basically is what Job did for his three friends. Now, he could have said, I'm not offering sacrifice for them. They're a bunch of jerks. But he didn't. He offered the sacrifice, and in doing so, he prayed for them that they'd get their hearts where it ought to be. How did Job's priestly intercession honor the principle taught in Matthew 5:44? He interceded for his three friends who had basically been very despitefully using him. As they said, Job, your problem is you're just wicked, you've sinned, and you deserve to be judged. And which, again, I think we need to learn from that. Be careful that you don't pounce on someone when something goes wrong for them to indicate, yeah, they've sinned, that's their problem, and to make that kind of a judgment. In verse 9, so Eliphaz, the Temanite, Bildad, the Shuhite, Zophar, the Naamathite, went and did according as the Lord commanded them. The Lord also accepted Job. All three did as commanded. They brought their sacrifices to Job. He offered them before God. The phrase then, the Lord accepted Job, means his trial was over. Sacrifice was made. God had accepted him. The trial was over. He had lived through a horrible experience, but he did it successfully with God's help. So God restored Job's health in verse 10, and the Lord turned the captivity of Job when he prayed for his friends. Also, the Lord gave Job twice as much that he had before. When Job prayed for his friends, God then reversed all of his problems. Job received grace for grace. God was glorified through his grace in Job. God restored him twice what he had before. God proved to Satan that a just man enabled by the grace of God can withstand any crisis. God allowed Job to be severely tested. He passed the test. Satan's proposition that Job would turn on God if God's blessing were removed was proven to be false. And that really is the whole book of Job. It starts with Satan saying, take away what he's got, take away his health, he'll curse your name. Job passed the test. He did not curse God's name. Biblical truth is illustrated here. Turn with me to Romans 8:28. Probably most of you could quote it, but let's turn back there if you need to. This verse really explains, I think, the book of Job. Romans 8:28, and we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purposes. But that all things can sometimes be a little difficult. But we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are called according to his purposes. When bad things happen, can we admit God's doing it for good? All things work together for good. The book of Job proves that verse. Even the bad things we may have to go through, they work together for God's good. God has a purpose. He knows exactly what he's doing in all things. It doesn't say the good things. It says, and all things work together for good. Then there's another reference here back to Psalms 5:12. Psalms 5:12, for thou, Lord, wilt bless the righteous. With favor wilt thou compass him as with a shield, which is a promise of God. Coming back here to the notes, biblical truth is illustrated here. The principle of Romans 8:28 is shown here. God allowed a season of trouble for Job, but he was the better for it. Psalms 5:12 is also illustrated. God blessed a righteous man. Though his friends falsely accused him, God never left him. Though Satan had been allowed to fiercely attack Job, he never wavered. He just did not understand what was happening. And that was the whole thing with Job questioning. It wasn't that he didn't trust God. He just didn't understand what he was going through. And as we noted, actually wished that he had not been born. God then gave Job the comfort of his siblings and friends in verse 11. Then came there unto him all his brethren and all his sisters and all they that had been of his acquaintance before and did eat bread with him in his house. And they bemoaned him and comforted him over all the evil that the Lord had brought upon him. Every man also gave him a piece of money and every one an earring of gold. So hardships sometimes draw families together. Job's brothers and sisters and many friends visited him after he went through his trials. Now that was clear. Now that it was clear that Job was on the winning team, his greater family and friends wanted a piece of action, which I think is also probably a little bit sad when you think about it. After finally God restores all this to him, then his family and friends come to visit. Where were they when he was in the midst of a problem? It wasn't until everything was going good that they showed up. But they comforted him and mourned for him because of the trials that he'd endured. They also took an offering for him, each giving him a piece of gold, piece of money, and a gold earring, which probably helped to restore his finances once again. In verse 12, so the Lord blessed the latter end of Job more than his beginning, for he had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, and 1,000 she asses. So God actually doubled his wealth. And the notes there, I give you the comparison. Originally, when you go back in chapter 1, he had 7,000 sheep. Now he has 14,000. He had 3,000 camels, now 6,000. 500 yoke of oxen, now 1,000. 500 donkeys, now 1,000 of them. Why God made the numbers exact, I have no idea, but he literally doubled everything that he had from the beginning. Though God allowed Job to be severely tested, God in the end gave him twice the blessings he had previously had. Now, when you read through this, this is one of those things where you kind of lose the point a little bit. And you read through that, and wow, one day he's poor and the next day he's rich. Obviously, that took a lot of years for him to build back that wealth again. But he was able to build it in the years which God did give him. So God tested him, but he came through the test. God then gave Job more children in verse 13. He also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. So God gave Job a second set of children, 7 sons, 3 daughters. Someone has said that the same woman who had encouraged Job to curse God and die, back in chapter 2, verse 9, was the same woman who got to endure 10 more pregnancies. That's not original with me, so don't blame me for that. I copied that out of somebody's commentary. Verse 14, and he called the name of the first Jemima, and the name of the second Keziah, and the name of the third Keren-Hapuk. His sons were not named, but his 3 daughters are. And I tried to pronounce them once. I won't be fool enough to do that again. Verse 15, and all the land were no women found so fair as the daughters of Job, and their father gave them inheritance among their brethren. So they were very beautiful girls. They were most beautiful in the land. He also gave them an inheritance, which was not the custom. Usually that went to the men, but his daughters were given inheritance. God gave Job an additional 140 years of healthy and prosperous living in verse 16. And after this lived Job 140 years, and he saw his sons and his sons' sons and even 4 generations. Tradition records that Job was 70 years old when he went through the trial. That does not say that in the book of Job. That comes from Jewish tradition, which very likely could be true. Just because it comes from tradition doesn't mean it's false. And so it's very likely he may have been 70 years of age when he went through these trials, but it is true that he lived twice as long after his trial. He did live 140 years after this. God gave Job the privilege of enjoying 4 generations of descendants. As it says there, he saw his sons' sons, even 4 generations. So Job died being old and full of years. So God was merciful not to let Job die when he wanted to. Again, you go back to what we've studied. Remember, he told God, just let me die. I don't want to live. You see what would have happened if God had let him die? Now, I don't doubt for a minute there are people sitting here that have time and even prayed that God would just take their life and they'd be done. That's not uncommon. But you see what Job would have cheated himself out of if God had listened to his prayer? That's a lesson, I think, very much for us in particular, that we realize that when you get down and things get difficult and you say, Lord, I just want to die and go to heaven. Maybe God has something else yet for you. Don't assume something that you can't see and you don't know. Let God be sovereign. Let Him take care of those things. He would have died in loneliness, barrenness, and misery. As it was, Job died a happy and fulfilled man. He lived to enjoy four generations, the great, great grandchildren. The passing of time reveals the timeless truth that God knows what is best for us and does what is best for us. God was glorified in Job during and after his ordeal. Praise the Lord. God gave Job a personal encounter with himself. Had it not been for his trial, Job would have never experienced his personal encounter with God when God spoke to him out of the whirlwind. God gave Job the spiritual benefit of seeing himself as he really was. As a result of this whirlwind encounter with God, Job saw himself as he really was, vile. He gained a deeper appreciation of God's grace. And then God's reward and rewards and blesses faithful believers today. Our ultimate reward is reserved in heaven, but that does not mean he cannot reward us sometimes today. The conclusion, when someone goes through a trial, we need to be careful we do not judge them thinking they have sinned. That's possible they might have, but I think we need to remember we're not the judge. We need to comfort those in trials, not criticize them. Job never turned against God, though he did not understand what was happening. Because he was faithful, God rewarded him accordingly. He was given long life, a new family, and double the possessions. Praise be to God. We've got 10 minutes. I think I'm going to go ahead and have the men pass out the next section. The next one, basically, what I've done is kind of summarized the book of Job. I have it entitled, The Suffering and Sovereignty, and this is done, of course, in retrospect. The lesson of sovereign design, a key issue in the book of Job, is not why, but who. Job was never told why, but he was instructed to keep trusting God. And as we already read this morning, Romans 8:28, we know that all things work together for good. To them that love God, to them are the called according to his purpose. Now, the lesson of emotion. Job is an emotional book. It's actually a drama in poetry. And, of course, we lose this when you translate because you can't translate poetry and keep it poetry. What I've done here is actually gone through and summarized the book of Job. And if you could put it in poetry, this would have been poetry. In chapter 1, verse 9, Satan speaks. In chapter 1, 14 to 19, Job learns his loss. And then chapter 1, 21, Job speaks. Chapter 2, verse 9, Job's wife speaks. Chapter 3, 3 through 11, Job speaks. Chapter 3, 24 through 26, Job speaks again. Chapter 5, 1 through 3, Eliphaz speaks. Chapter 7, 5 through 7, Job answers Eliphaz. Chapter 8, 1 through 4, Bildad speaks. Chapter 10, verse 1, Job spoke to Bildad. Chapter 11, 1 through 4, you have Zophar speaks. Chapter 13, verse 15, Job spoke back to Zophar. 16, 1 and 2, Job spoke to Eliphaz. Chapter 19, 2 and 3, Job spoke to Bildad. Chapter 19, 25 through 27, Job again spoke to Bildad. Chapter 21, 2 through 3, Job spoke to Zophar. Chapter 23, 10, Job spoke to Eliphaz. Chapter 32, 2 through 10, Elihu to Job. 38, 1 through 4, God spoke to Job, and it was out of the whirlwind. Chapter 43 through 5, Job to God. Chapter 42, 6, Job to God. Chapter 42, 11, Job's family and friends. And chapter 42, 12, God doubled his possessions. And that's kind of a quick summary of the book of Job. Again, it was originally in poetic form. The lessons of God, of good and evil. This story demonstrates the powerful conflict between the devil and the people of God. It demonstrates that even evil is under God's sovereign control. In other words, they can't ever go beyond what God actually allows. Satan could not cross the hedge and that God had built around Job. God uses fiery trials to refine our character. Turn back to chapter 23 and verse 10. This is, I think, a key verse in the book of Job, 23:10. But he knoweth the way that I take. When he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. That's one of them that I've added to my memory packet, and because it's just a good reminder. But he knoweth the way that I take. Does God really know that? But he knoweth the way that I take. When he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. That's the story of Job. He did come forth as gold. But it's a good verse to apply to our own personal lives. You have the lesson of humble trust. During severe trials, we need to recognize the sovereignty of God and trust him with a comforted heart. Comfort from the book of Job. And I'm not going to take time to look up all of those references. If you do that on your own, you can see each one of them refers to how God comforted Job. In chapter 12, verse 13, God understands. 19:25, God is our Redeemer. And he said, I know my Redeemer liveth. And chapter 19:26, God will resurrect our bodies. And that's when he talked about, though the skin worms destroy our body, yet in my flesh I shall see God. Chapter 19:25, we will see God. Chapter 23:10, our character is refined, as we just read. Job 38:4, God is in control. Job 42:7-9, God is our vindicator. And 42:10-17, God rewards those who humbly trust in him. And those are verses of comfort from the book of Job. Lessons of defense. Job defended himself against false accusations. Job was very honest and open. How should a suffering believer respond to the charge that he is suffering because he sinned? How should a terminally ill believer respond to the charge that he lacks faith? The lesson of perspective. Our perspective of life can get very distorted in the heat of a trial. For Job, it was hard to keep his perspective in life. According to the book of Job, what really matters in this life? That is the question. But it is true. You can get in the midst of physical problems, other problems, and because you're weighed down with the problem of all of that, you can kind of lose your perspective. That's why the book of Job was written, to help us not do that. The lesson of helping those who hurt. What can we learn from the book of Job about being a better friend and counselor? Although Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar came to comfort Job, they did the opposite. They added misery to misery. And I would suggest, if you never learned anything from the book of Job, maybe learn this one thing. When someone has a problem, another believer has a problem, don't pounce on them and try to solve their problem. Now, if they ask you and they need counsel, fine, but I've seen this too much. Someone has a problem. Yeah, I don't think that guy saved. His life doesn't show it. You know, you've become God when you do that. They may be saved and just not in the right place they ought to be. Don't be that judge. Let God take care of that. That's too easy when you see someone have a problem. We make a judgment. Oh, I know why they've got the problem. That's what they did with Job. All three of his friends. So just learn from that. Learn to be compassionate, helpful counselors. You know, a lot of times you don't have to say anything more than just say, well, brother, I'm praying for you. A lot of times you don't have to say any more than that. Just encourage them. Learn that from the book of Job. His friends were no help whatsoever. How to truly comfort someone? Number one, empathize genuinely with the one who hurts. Two, pray earnestly for those who hurt. Three, do not ignore expressions of physical or emotional pain. Four, do not talk too much. Listen. Number five, do not become argumentative. Six, do not belittle the one who hurts. Seven, do not assume that you know all of the answers. And eight, do not condemn with words that hurt. Number nine, share encouraging words from God's promises. And 10, tenderly pray with the one who hurts. I think that's good admonition. And that's something that should be learned from the book of Job. That concludes our study of the book of Job. I do hope it's been some help and benefit to you in your personal life. Peter.